Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, the meaning of money. We're going to talk to an expert on how to reframe how you see your financial circumstances. David Cunningham from Landmark Worldwide will be our guest. We'll follow that with a conversation about resilience, financial resilience. Jim Yee of Retire Happy will be our guest for that. And later, why budgeting doesn't work. A contrarian view from David Covey, the co-author of Trap Tales, Outsmarting the Seven Hidden Obstacles to Success. Plus, attention points collectors, you might just be able to use your obsession for good. There's a charity that helps you give travel points to families dealing with terminal illnesses. We'll talk to the founder of Give a Mile. All that is ahead. Let's get started. Today, we're going to look at the facts of money and our interpretations about those facts. David Cunningham is a program leader at Landmark Worldwide, a personal and professional growth training and development company. Hello, David.
Hello, Bruce.
The meaning of money differs for everyone. Why is that?
Well, Bruce, whenever you and I have a life experience, when something happens to us, whether we're aware of it or not, in the next moment, we have an interpretation of what happened. Simple example is we're talking to somebody, and while we're talking to them, they glance at their watch. That's what happens. They glance at their watch. We have an interpretation, something like, oh, they're not interested in what I'm saying. For all of us growing up, we had many different things that happened with regard to money. And when those events happened, we had interpretations of them. We interpreted them. We came up with stories about those events. And long after the events are over, as adults, what you and I, we have a view of money. We have money mean something, and it's an accumulation of all of those decisions, interpretations, stories we made up about money throughout the course of our lifetime and all those different events.
And why does that matter? Like, how does that play out? Why are interpretations so important?
That matters in two really critical ways, Bruce. Number one is what you and I think is possible, what people think is possible, is not given by the facts of their life or the circumstances, but by their view of those circumstances. You know, I ran a marathon recently, and in the marathon, I ran next to a guy who had no legs. He was doing the whole marathon in a wheelchair. What did he prove to us? He proved that whether you have legs or not does not determine whether you think it's possible to do a marathon. It's your view of that circumstance. Mm. So with money in particular, we have a view of money given by our interpretations that we've accumulated over the years. And it's that view of money, not the money we have or don't have. It's the view of money that determines what we think is possible and not possible for us.
So let's take a case, a credit card debt. Here, the average outstanding debt on a credit card is about $3,500, and you can imagine how high that goes just to have the average be that way. If that's the fact, using your very clear way of speaking, what could be some interpretations that would go along with that fact?
There could be one of two different sides. One interpretation could be, wow, I'm not good with money, or wow, I'm in trouble here.
You're being very polite in the way that you say it. I think people's inner voice would be like, oh, my God, this is a disaster.
That's right. The other side of it could be, this isn't too bad. Okay. This is okay. This is normal. But either side of the coin, they're both interpretations about the $3,500 in debt. And then what people respond to is not the $3,500. What people respond to is their interpretation. So if my interpretation is, oh, I'm in trouble here, they'll start their emotions, their thoughts, what they think of doing, not doing, what they think is possible will all be in response to the interpretation called I'm in trouble versus responding directly to, oh, I have $3,500 in credit card debt.
So you've got two people standing side by side with the exact same credit card statement, and how they feel about that credit card statement could be completely different, and what they do about that outstanding balance could be completely different.
And what will determine that is the interpretation they have about that, not the $3,500 itself.
Now, in your programs that you lead, you must interact with people and coach people all the time in this particular area, and they must hold on to their view that the fact is I'm terrible with money or I'm in trouble. They must, I'm sure, protest to the heavens that there could be any other interpretation other than the one that they have.
That's right. So we find it very useful. Sometimes I tell people, Bruce, just to take out a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle, and on one at the top of the left-hand column, write the word facts. And at the top of the right-hand column, write interpretation or story. And really do the rigorous work to separate out what's a fact versus what's an interpretation. And sometimes you have to really, you know, get rigorous with it. You know it's a fact because it's undebatable. Nobody would disagree with it. It's, you know, you can see it. It's an interpretation because other people may disagree with it. It's made up. It's added to the fact. So it's critical that people separate those out.
What next? So they've separated it out. They're willing to buy what you're selling. Okay, all right, this could be an interpretation. Maybe there's another interpretation. What? How do they then go and, I don't know, can they go to Costco to buy a new interpretation? Where do they get one?
Well, believe it or not, I don't recommend they come up with a new interpretation. I got something better.
Okay.
When you get the interpretation as an interpretation and not a fact, you get a clean slate. See, if you come up with another interpretation, let's suppose your first interpretation is I'm in trouble, and then you go, okay, I got that's an interpretation. Let me make up an interpretation called this isn't too bad. What you'll do is you'll spend the rest of your time debating which one of those interpretations is true.
Right.
Bruce, here's what's critical, Bruce, is people get that neither of them are true. They're both interpretations. That literally no interpretation is true. So if you get that and you literally go, okay, the fact, $3,500 credit card debt, no interpretation. I'm not going to have any interpretation. I'm just going to have the fact be the fact. Guess what? Right there, you get a clean slate about that $3,500. And you'll notice something. You'll notice that literally there's some peace of mind. There's some, you know, freedom that you experience. And what's better than coming up with a new interpretation that moment, Bruce, is actually inventing or creating something new possible for you. Like literally some new possibility for yourself in being powerful free. Like, oh, I can be powerful with money, or I can be creative with money. That's different than an interpretation. It's literally saying something new is possible that you didn't say was possible before. When you get a clean slate.
What are some of the benefits that you see in your programs? And people who come in, they took the program because they're really, really dealing with money. It's a huge and troubling issue for them in their life. What are some of the benefits? They come back to you. I don't know. You see them the next week or the next month or the next year. What are some things that they say, hey, David, thanks so much for leading my course because this is what I took away from it?
Three things. One is, first off, their whole self-image relationship with themselves. You know, whatever was disempowering, that literally goes away. It disappears. Number two, they stop arguing with other people about it, especially if somebody's married or in a relationship or financially in some agreement with somebody. The interpretations we have are the source of most of the arguments. People argue over the interpretations, not the facts. Third thing is that when that happens, people find themselves taking actions they never took before. Like literally they call the creditor and ask for the amount to be reduced, or they call somebody they've never thought of calling and have them invest in their business and have new sources of money they never had before. Because, again, what limits what we think is possible is the interpretations about our money, not the money itself.
Very interesting. David, thank you very much for your insight. It is both delightfully simple and brutally complex because you're introducing a new notion, a new way to think and act when it comes to money. I appreciate you taking the time. David Cunningham is a program leader at Landmark Worldwide, a personal and professional growth training and development company. LandmarkWorldwide.com is their website.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Resilience is the capacity to recover quickly from difficulties. It's much easier to maintain resilience when your mental health is strong and much harder when it isn't. Jim Yee is an author and blogger behind RetireHappy.ca. He joins us now to talk about how to build financial resilience. Hello there, Jim.
Good day, Bruce.
You had a piece on Retire Happy about the 10 traits of resilience written by Sarah Milton. There are some really, really great ones here. I want to look at a couple of them from a financial perspective. You ready?
Awesome.
The first is choose your network carefully. This is, we've heard this, that you want to earn more money, hang around with wealthier people. In the context of resilience, how do you look at that trait?
Well, key financial trait for success is just literally to look around your lives. You know, sometimes we think that financial advisors and professionals are the key to success, and I still think they're important. But I think it's more important to look at your immediate network and your immediate surroundings of people. And you know, like if you hang around a bunch of frugal people that are proud to coupon shop and like to talk about the best deals they find, it's going to rub off on you. But if you hang around people that like to go to Vegas, stay in really expensive hotels and eat out all the time, and you're going to get drawn into that. And whether you can afford it or not, it's the social pressure can sometimes be very, very difficult. I see it with kids, and we as adults think that we know better, but we are highly, highly influenced by the people we hang around with.
Yeah.
And so, just take a step, look back, look around at your, and I'm not saying you got to get rid of all your friends, but I am saying that, that watch how they influence your spending and your habits when it comes to dealing with money, and from a resilience perspective, if you're in a neighborhood and you got laid off, or you made a bad investment, how much is it related to the network and the surroundings that you're in?
One of the other traits is build self-awareness, which in the context we're talking to Kate Flanders about what she has chosen to do with a portion of her emergency fund. There is, I think, a real value in investing in the kind of self-care that you flag here.
Yeah, self-awareness can mean so many different things to different people. From a financial perspective, I talk about the basics, finance 101. If I were able to teach this to, maybe high school students or university students or whatever, simply being aware of your financial state and it is critical to your success. People pay attention to their finances. They know their net worth. They know their spending. They know where their money's invested. They're going to have a huge advantage versus those that don't. And unfortunately, 25 years in this business, I've seen so many people that you ask them a question like, how much you're worth, and they have no clue. Where's your money invested? No clue. And so just being aware of your finances is important. And then also beyond the numbers, being aware of your personality and how it relates to finances. You and I have talked about, we're both not the frugal coupon shoppers, but some people are, and that's okay. But if you're not, that's okay too. But you have to be aware of who you are, and if you're not a coupon shopper, then you better focus on other aspects like, in income generation. Maybe that's your thing.
Yep.
And, different aspects like that. So be aware.
Yes. Be aware. Another one is consider possibilities. So resilient people are willing to explore a change of perspective or considering altering their course rather than stubbornly sticking to the path. That's hard when the market's bouncing around and people get very concerned about their retirement savings.
Well, there is something to be said about experience. I often joke about, in my retirement workshops, I ask people, I say, how many of you have gotten more stubborn the older you get,
And what do they say?
And they say, yeah, of course, you earn the right to be more stubborn, right? But at the same time, you know, sometimes we get trapped into being overly stubborn, and you know, the world changes quickly. The options that we have available to us have changed quickly. When I first came into this business, you know, ETFs were nothing. Like, I didn't, you know, ETFs didn't exist, and now, you know, the growing popularities. When I first came into this business, GICs were paying 10%. And yet we were trying to convince, or, you know, people about this world of mutual funds and markets.
You are very, very old. I have no idea how old you are. My goodness.
You could get a GIC for 10%.
You're going to tell me there was a world before the internet, aren't you? Jeez.
So, you know, consider the possibilities is you know, we've heard it before. Think outside the box from time to time. And I believe that we're all, to a certain extent, creatures of habits. And I use, you know, anecdotally, the 80-20 rule, that 80% of our life is very habitual, very patterned, very routine. But there's 20% where, you know, we're tired, we're looking for something different. And sometimes resiliency requires that you look outside that box. Mm. And resiliency is, you know, when you hit those tough times, that's the best time to just take stock and say, hey, can I do this differently? Can I be better? Can I? Because you can get caught up in the whole, oh, you know, my life sucks and it's all on me. But, you know, I think truly resilient people, they for whatever reason, they think beyond their problems. Mm. They look for solutions. And sometimes those solutions aren't conventional solutions. You got to look further than what you're used to.
Robbing a bank, opening up a grow op, all the, you know, think outside of the legal paradigm. Is that what you're saying? Can I quote you on that?
You've never had a problem with this one, have you, Bruce?
Never, never. Now, calm your brain is another one here. And you reference, of course, how overwhelming financial stress can be. Talk about that kind of, I don't know, Zen, the importance of that Zen attitude when life's chaotic.
Yeah. So, you know, I think of the word anxiety. You know, what I often in the retirement world, I ask people, do you have a case of retirement anxiety? And many people do. And anxiety is created from the unknown. When you don't know what's ahead, like if you're walking in a brand new city and you're not sure, you know, where to go, it creates anxiety. And finances is no different, right? When you get caught in a tough situation and you want to get out of this thing and you have anxiety, it's tough to act calmly. And so sometimes you have to find ways to calm your brain, calm yourself. The analogy I use, I coach soccer, and these little kids, when they get injured, they're crying, they're screaming. And the first thing I say is just take a deep breath, take a deep breath. And when you can calm your body and you can calm your brain down, you know, all of a sudden you can start to think rationally and you can realize, okay, this isn't so bad. I can get up, I can walk off the field. And from a financial perspective, same thing. If you can calm your brain, take a deep breath. Maybe it's yoga, maybe it's Zen, maybe it's meditation. I don't know what it is. Like, whatever you like to do to calm down. And then once you've done that, consider the possibilities, you know, look at your surroundings, look outside the box and move forward.
Boring. Oh my gosh. No, I wasn't bored. I just think I fell asleep there. I was breathing and I was like, all of a sudden I was asleep. Jim, that was amazing. You could be my new meditation instructor.
Oh yes.
Could you do that?
We'll both fall asleep. That.
Jim, thank you for your tips on financial resilience. Jimmy's the person behind the Retire Happy blog. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bruce.
Coming up later on Moolah La, what you need to know before you agree to becoming an executor. But next, the money trap. I'll talk to David Covey, co-author of Trap Tales, outsmarting the 7 hidden obstacles to success. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry on Facebook. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. I'm Bruce Ellery. If you just knew where the traps were in life, perhaps you could avoid them. That's the premise of a new book called Trap Tales, Outsmarting the Seven Hidden Obstacles to Success. One of the traps, perhaps no surprise, is the money trap. The book's co-author, David Covey, joins us now from Atlanta, Georgia. Hello there, David.
How you doing, Bruce?
You are a Covey, as in Stephen Covey, the author of The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Did you consider, for even a second, using the number 6 or 8 in the title of your book?
It wasn't even an option. Even if I had tried to do it, if I had 6, somehow 7 would emerge.
7 would have emerged.
If I had 8, it would have been reduced down to 7. Except for my father did have the 8th habit, so maybe there is an 8th trap somewhere in the world.
The magic is there somewhere. Well, I'm going to focus on the money trap, but before I drill down into that, I want to ask you about what you call the basic traits of traps. That sounds like the foundation for everything you say.
Yes. It's the characteristics of a trap. So, you know, really these are traps that people fall into both in life and work, and they're seductive. There's four characteristics. Seductive, you know, lures you in unknowingly. They're deceptive. So you think that the short-term gratification will lead to, you know, it eventually leads to long-term pain. They're sticky. They're like quicksand. You know, they are easy to fall into and hard to get out. And they're limiting. You know, the trap really limits you from progressing towards your goals and the success we seek in our life.
So what is the money trap?
So the money trap is the trap that is the quicksand of debt. And, you know, there's three reasons why we fall into the money trap or the debt trap. First of all, we have, you know, money myopia. You know, we want to live in the now, and so we can't wait for anything. We have to have it now. We have this competitive consumption mentality. We're trying to keep up with the Joneses, and we see everybody around us that has all that stuff, and we want that stuff as well, so we try to keep up with them. And then also we're in denial. You know, the biggest challenge with debt is we think that worst-case scenarios don't apply to us until they actually happen.
Right.
And then we find ourselves in debt, and we're in, you know, paying all this interest, and it's just a killer trap that limits so many people. So, you know, really in life, you know, especially young people, you know, you have to make a decision whether you're going to be a person that's going to be paying interest or making interest. Albert Einstein called compound interest the 8th wonder of the world. And it is. You know, if you can start now when you're young, when you're 20 or 30, and say, you know what, I'm going to be in the business of making interest instead of paying interest.
Right.
And staying entirely out of the debt trap.
The line that caught my attention was, why budgeting doesn't work. In my world, that's kind of sacrilegious. What exactly do you mean?
It's very sacrilegious. So in each one of the traps, we have the conventional approach of how to get out of the trap. And then we have what we call the epiphany breakthrough, which is really the new insight that's going to lead to a breakthrough in the behavior. So the for the money trap, the conventional approach is to say, hey, budget, be disciplined, you know, exercise restraint. And I'm not saying there's nothing; those aren't good things. They are good things. I'm just saying budgeting is a lot like New Year's resolutions. They sound great. You have a lot of fanfare and kick it off in a big way, but
and then the champagne wears off, and you wake up with a massive headache. I think that's how New Year's goes, right?
And willpower is overrated. And I'm saying you have to make debt more interesting and fun and more engaging. I mean, it sounds strange saying that, but you can get the family around it and other people excited around, you know, reducing the debt. And by creating a scoreboard, we suggest in the book to create a debt snake, a debt paper snake. And as you make progress on, you know, reducing your debt, you start cutting up the snake. You have it like in $1,000 increments for the debt that you have, whether it be consumer debt or credit card debt. And I'm saying that is a far more effective way in getting out of debt than budgeting.
I love this example of the snake. I think it's visual. It's practical. Why a snake? Where did the idea of the snake come from?
Well, it was just the idea of, you know, the snake is, you know, maybe people saw some Disney and they remember Ka, the snake, you know, is just trying to strangle Mowgli, the boy. You know, the snake is, you know, it's kind of fits those descriptions of a trap, and it can choke you. You know, literally, that is suffocating, and it's you know, and it just so harmful to you. So we just thought it would be a good metaphor to have something where you have this snake that you need to kill in your life. So I don't know. I'm sure there's a few people out there that like snakes, but most people are like Harrison Ford, you know, where they say, and you know, that movie he was in, that, you know, I hate snakes. And
right.
So I think most people would rather get rid of snakes than keep their pet snakes.
Right. The Indiana Jones. And you're actually talking about a craft here. Like you're making a snake out of paper, putting it up somewhere and snipping it off in inches as you bring that debt down. Your character in this book involves his kids. Do you really think it's realistic to expect that kind of engagement from kids? I read it and thought, wow, like there's a lot of unicorns and rainbows floating around in that world. My 7-year-old would be like, not playing.
So absolutely there is. And this story in the book actually emerges from my own life story. So not everything about Alex is related to me, but there's a lot of stuff in the book that's related to me. But this particular story, we found ourselves, our family, we had $90,000 of credit card debt. We got carried away with trying to get points and getting all these rewards and so forth. And before we knew it, we had $90,000 of credit card debt. And it was totally suffocating. We tried budgeting for a while. And my wife and I would just fight over it. And, you know, we got in more arguments and we weren't very successful with that. And so we created this snake. I think it was my wife that came up with the idea of the snake and then put it in our kitchen and family room. It was very visible. It was very present. And it, you know, people would come over to our house and they'd see this huge paper snake in our family room and kitchen area. And our kids at that time, I had 4 kids. I have 7 now. Of course, I got to have 7, right? 7
of course.
Kids.
Absolutely.
But I had 4 kids and the kids were so involved in it, they would ask, you know, they would want to know when the, you know, credit card statements were going to come out. This was kind of before everything was, you know, done pretty much online, but they, you know, wanted to know where the credit card statements are and see what we could reduce. They wanted to be the ones that cut up the snake.
Head first or tail first?
Mom and I. And they would say stuff like, you know, well, I'd like to buy this, but, you know, that would just add to our snake. So I don't want to do that. I'd rather cut up that lousy old snake. So no, I don't want to get that Lego set that, you know, that costs $129. I'm gonna wait, Dad. And I was shocked. I was totally shocked because I was not expecting this at all from my kids. I thought that I would not be able to engage them, and it was the opposite. They were totally engaged, totally interested, got them involved in it. And, you know, if you had a family, it's hard to just do it alone. You can't go alone. You know, you got to have people on board. And if you can get your, you know, your spouse and your kids on board, it makes a world of difference.
Yeah. Did they cut off the head first or the tail first?
Well, the head didn't get, you don't get it. We got to burn the head. So it was the tail first, and then we started cutting up the body. And then at the end, once all the debt is gone, then you can have a little fire and you can burn the head. And, you know, the head was like this 10-inch head, very colorful, and they put jewels on it. And
what an amazing ritual.
It was a big event when we burned the snake's head.
David, I really appreciate you joining us. I wish we had more time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Covey is co-author of Trap Tales, Outsmarting the 7 Hidden Obstacles to Success, including putting a snake up on your wall. Interesting. Coming up, do good by donating your airline points. I'll talk to the founder of Give a Mile. And later, advice from an estate expert. Jim Yee says, settling an estate is not an honor, it is work. Choose your executor carefully to ensure that he or she can handle the job. We'll tell you what that means. I've written a couple of books myself. You can order them online. The first is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things with Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Families going through a health crisis have so much weighing on them. The emotional burden is enormous, and so too can be the financial burden. Kevin Crowe made it his mission to do something about that part of it. He founded a nonprofit called Give a Mile, an organization that turns airline points into flights for families that really need them. He joins us now from Calgary, Alberta. Hello there.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
This idea was not theoretical in nature. It has very personal roots. Tell us about your friend Ryan and how your experience with him was an inspiration for you in founding Give a Mile.
Yeah, absolutely. I lost an amazing friend to brain cancer. And the last year of Ryan's life, we spent a huge amount of time together. And I saw the impact of having loved ones, being able to visit and support Ryan. And he really taught me the concept of time and how powerful time is, you know. And Ryan realized that there was no more treatments available and said, you know, Ryan, what is it that you want? He said, I just want time with the people I loved. He had a 4.5-year-old son, a wife, and a huge amount of friends and family. And just to witness those people getting time with Ryan was just such an amazing gift. And in the hospice, we just saw so many families that were not able to fly in and say goodbye and spend that valuable time. And we wanted to fix that.
Hence the creation of Give a Mile. Tell us how it works for both flyers and for contributors of points.
Yeah, what Give a Mile is about is having people donate their unused travel or loyalty miles to make these flights of compassion happen so that mothers, fathers, brothers, sons, sisters, daughters can be there and get that time with a loved one. We work with the hospices and social workers and healthcare providers to identify families. It's a very simple application process. We try to make it, you know, just 2 pages, and we have a flight review team that looks at those applications. And once the flight's approved, we book that for the family and send that to the family so they can fly in. And people can go to giveamile.org and they'll actively see the flights we're working on, and they can donate to those specific stories. And it's a 100% donation model. We accept Aeroplan miles. We accept American Express. And it's as well, people can donate money if they don't have loyalty miles.
What is a flight hero?
Yeah. A flight hero is somebody that's willing to take on using their network of friends and family to raise a specific flight. We're all about tangible outcome and understanding the impact you make happen. So we say 25 friends, 25 days, 25,000 miles. That's what makes a flight happen. And so by working with your network, posting on Facebook or having a dinner event or, you know, tweeting out to your friends and raising those miles, we'll connect you to a specific flight story so you know who you've flu and kind of the impact of that flight, and you can obviously feel amazing in your heart.
When any of us use points, when we redeem them, there are often taxes that go along with the ticket, and sometimes it feels anything but free. How does that get covered in your model?
Yeah, absolutely. We do a bunch of fundraising events, and so we have several events through the year and several key corporate sponsors who help us with the taxes and fees as well as our operating expenses. So when you donate your miles, you know they're going to create that flight and you don't have to worry about the impact.
What has been the participation on the part of the points companies and on the airlines? How are they getting in on this idea?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Aeroplan's been an incredible partner since the beginning. They found out about us on our first flight, and they made us a charity so people can donate their miles for a $0 transfer fee. They also get on board for our Christmas campaign. Last year, we made 42 flights happen for families at Christmas, and they matched up to 250,000 miles for us. So they've been an incredible partner and supporter. And, you know, the airlines are helping us in the sense of when we are booking flights, and sometimes we need to upgrade people because of the pain when they're flying. You know, we also fly people that are palliatively ill to be home with their loved ones. They've upgraded seats for free. They've also helped us move and rebook airline tickets because obviously there's cancellations and things that happen. And they've been great and very supportive and flexible for us.
When you look ahead, say 5 years, 10 years, where do you want to see Give a Mile go?
you know, our big, hairy, audacious dream is to give 1 billion miles back to people through this giving model. Currently, we're at 338 flights, just going into our fourth year. 11.4 million miles have been used. So we've got a lot of way to go to make that big, hairy, audacious dream go. But we would love to have, you know, the vast majority of loyalty point programs participating in this. We'd love to have the airlines fully participating in this and make this a global giving mechanism, a model. You know, there's over 10 trillion, that's trillion with a T, travel miles that are sitting on the sidelines unused globally every year. And we want to tap into that and make social good happen and obviously help these families that are dealing with such a stressful event.
Some people participate in points programs for a period of time, but not forever. And they have, or they've redeemed and they've got, you know, like orphan points. They're just kind of sitting there not doing much and they won't amount to much even over the course of time. Is that an easy way for people to contribute points that they just may not use?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see a couple buckets of giving. You know, there's people that just feel they'll never have enough miles to make a flight happen, and they can absolutely donate. And there's the other end where you have business travelers who are traveling so much, they never feel they can redeem all their points, and so they can donate as well. And the nice thing is it keeps your account active. I know people are worried about their accounts expiring. So when you make a donation, it considers your account active, and so your expiry date's reset. We also have businesses that do things like they put their payroll through on credit cards, like payroll by credit card, and that's creating assets for them, and they're participating by donating a certain percentage every month to us. And so there's so many ways to use these miles to make good happen.
You must hear some incredible stories. Is there one from the last, you know, couple months or year that sticks with you, keeps you going when you realize, geez, this is a lot of work sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, the working with the families is incredibly inspiring, and the courage and just the strength of those families every day really kind of grows your heart. And, you know, the one flight I would say that's really stuck out in the last couple months is we're flying grandparents in for a young boy who's going to have his second birthday, and it's going to be his last birthday. And those grandparents are going to be able to spend that time with the family, celebrate, have a special moment and special memories. And that wouldn't happen without the amazing volunteer team and donors behind us. And it just gives you goosebumps thinking about that.
It really does give you goosebumps thinking about it. Give a Mile, not for profit, easy way for you to make a difference by using your miles. Kevin, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kevin Crow is the founder of Give a Mile. He joined us from Calgary, Alberta. Coming up next, sure, of course I'll be the executor of your estate. Wait, hold on. What does that actually mean? Jim Yee will give us an idea of the responsibility and the work involved in being an executor. Now, you can subscribe to the podcast version of Moolah La on iTunes. Do that, and then stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Ellery. You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. Accepting the duty to be the executor of a friend or family member's estate is a decision not to be taken lightly. And yet most people don't give it much thought, maybe because it doesn't seem real, maybe because you would do anything for your friend, or maybe because you don't really know what it actually entails. Well, we're going to take a look at the role of executor with Jim Yee, author of Smart Tips for Estate Planning. Jim, this is a question I get asked a lot, so this is under the umbrella of Ask Anything the Executor. Geez, what is the first piece of advice you would provide for someone who's been asked to do this task? I didn't even know you could say no. I mean, of course you could say no, but there's some consequences that would go with that.
Well, you can say no, and it's okay to say no. That I think that's really important, is sometimes we feel really obligated when we're asked to do this. Sometimes we feel honored to be asked. But it's important for executors to know what they're getting into, and it can be a lot of work. And have you ever been executor, Bruce?
I have never, knock wood, never been executor. I'm on the documents for people who are going to die 85 years from today.
All right. I've still got
some time.
I jokingly say it's the worst job in the world, and we give it to the people we love the most. So, If you're going to be an executor, I think it's important to have some conversations with the person who's going to die.
Yeah.
It sounds so awful.
Well, here's your quote. You said, remember, settling your estate is not an honor. It's work. Choose your executor carefully to ensure that he or she can handle the job. So this is not the same as choosing your best man or your maid of honor for that one day wedding opportunity. Basically, you need them to look amazing in a tuxedo and not be hammered when they walk up the aisle. This is a bigger responsibility.
It is a big responsibility. So some of the things to look for, you know, choosing people who do not live where the assets are can be challenging. So, for example, my father, who's 86, there's myself and my sister. My sister lives in Salt Lake City. I live in Edmonton where my dad lives. So it's more logical to list myself as the executor. Listing my sister is a possibility. But it can be problematic when the location is not there. Choosing somebody who's responsible, somebody who's objective, somebody who has some financial experience, and enjoys that kind of stuff. I mean, the automatic defaults, we tend to pick our kids, our spouses, family members. But within your family's structures, my question is there somebody who's going to be better at being the executor than others?
Right.
And so, yeah, choose your executor wisely is pretty darn important.
You have listed a whole bunch of duties, ones that happen immediately after death, very soon after death, and then ones that continue as you have to wind up the estate. From a time perspective, I'm going to ask you from a time perspective and an emotional perspective, what are the biggest tasks that the executor will have to sort through?
Well, I think the first difficult part is just because often the executor is somebody that is close to the person that's passed away. So trying to get over the emotions from the perspective of you got a job, you got to get some stuff done. So, first finding the will, is there a will, and reviewing the will and arranging the funeral, that can always be tough. Is organ donation important? And then the next logical step is then finding the assets and figuring out, taking stock of what the estate is all about. The ongoing stuff tends to be, more, automatic, where you still have to pay bills and you still have to pay for expenses and like pay for the funeral and things like that. But it's the searching for things that can be really challenging. And so I always say, if you're gonna ask an executor, someone to be your executor, you can really help your executor by documenting and diarizing and communicating with your executor about where things are and if something happens. So in my household, we have what I call it the estate binder, the magic binder. And I say to my wife, Liz, if something happens to me, go to the binder.
It's all in the binder.
It's all there, obviously, having a magical binder requires updating, and that's a task in itself. But the more you can help your executors with proper documentation, proper organization, proper communication, the easier it is for that executor to do what they need to do. The hardest part is just finding stuff. It's again the unknown. What do I do? What do they want for a funeral? Where are the assets? How many bank accounts do they have? Do they have memberships? And the new one now is the Facebook account, digital assets, right, they call them. What are the passwords? How do I get into the electronic banking and Facebook, Instagram, Twitter? Do I need to do anything with these digital assets and whatnot? So that's the new part of estate planning that probably wasn't discussed, even 10, 15, 20 years ago.
So. What are the risks that executors should be aware of? What are the risks that they face?
Well, yeah, I mean, they do have liability because it is a formal relationship of, responsibility, the executor. So, they are responsible for filing a final tax return and making sure that all the debts and taxes are paid before the distribution of assets. So they want to make sure that they really have their, T's crossed and I's dotted and whatnot. So there is that responsibility. They have to make sure they carry out the wishes of the will. So they want to make sure that the will is valid and update and whatnot. So, there are some risks, but I wouldn't say huge risks.
Not that you would do this task for money, but you can, an executor can claim a fee. How does that work? How much is it?
Well, I think, in my personal opinion, they should claim a fee. As part of my experience with executors and having been one in the past, it is a lot of work, and I think that beneficiaries should respect that this task requires some compensation. So the compensation. If you can actually hire a third party executor. You can go to a trust company, and there's some, I'll call them professional executors that do this kind of thing. Quite often, they'll do it as a percentage of assets, which can be quite lucrative. You can pay hourly. There is no standards per se as to how much an executor should get paid. But if you use the professional world, it's quite often, some percentage of assets, 1%, 2%. But that can add up to quite a bit of
money, depending on the size of the estate. Well, Jim, let's hope you and I are decades away from needing to provide those services. But when we do, we will know that it is a very important task and do it well. Thank you for your time. You did this well.
Thank you, Bruce. Always a pleasure.
Jim Yee's author of Smart Tips for Estate Planning. The Moolala Questionnaire. It's a series of questions about money. We get our guest's first top-of-mind response. Our answer today, Kevin Crowe, the founder of Give a Mile, a not-for-profit, a charity that brings together people who have points with those who need them to fly to visit family members who've received some really tough health news. Kevin, hello.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so here is my series of questions. You can answer what is the first thing that comes to your mind. And the first question is, how would you describe your money personality?
Conservative.
Where do you think that comes from?
I grew up in a working class family, and my dad was an auto worker in the 80s, and obviously a lot of change going on in the auto industry at that time. And we were always concerned about, what was going to happen and if there was paychecks coming in. So, it was about paying things in cash and making sure there was a little bit in the savings and being prepared for a rainy day. And I think those were great values, and I've carried them into my adult life.
If you were to have one guilty spending pleasure, what would you say it was?
Oh, I think it's travel. I love adventure, and I love going places and experiencing new sights and sounds. And, it's so good when you spend money on experience and have those memories. And I think that'd be my guilty pleasure for sure.
If you were to spin the globe and pop your index finger on one city or country on that globe, where would it be right now? What do you have your eye on?
Oh, I got Istanbul. I've heard so many good things about it, and I have friends that have traveled there, and they've just said it's an amazing city full of energy and just so many sights and sounds there. I've got it on my bucket list.
Istanbul,
I got to make it happen.
Turkey. Okay, Istanbul, Turkey. That's I have been there. I can endorse that. I think you should make your way there. If you landed a huge financial windfall, and when I say huge, I'm saying $25 million. That may be chump change for you, but for me, that'd be a huge windfall. What would you do with it?
Oh, first, I absolutely would support Give a Mile. It's so near and dear to my heart. I'd make a big donation there and continue the work we've started there as well. Friends and family, helping them. And then, looking to some great ideas around technology and entrepreneurship and investing in some great entrepreneurs that are out there that just need that special investment to get to the next level. I think that would be the things I would do.
When do you plan to retire, assuming no financial windfall? When do you plan to retire, and what will you do?
you know, I don't know if I'm actually going to retire. You know, I'm very passionate about the work I do and I love it. And, you know, if retirement means not working, I don't think that's what I would do. But as far as maybe, you know, having a kind of more flexible day and maybe not so many hours of work, I'm hoping to do that around, you know, 55, between 55 and 60. And I really want to help mentor and grow leaders and give back to the community and participate with volunteering and those types of things.
What would you call your worst financial mistake?
Oh, man.
Do you say, oh, man, because you're like, how am I going to choose? I got 15 here. Or are you saying, oh, man, because you're thinking, I don't know. I never really did anything.
No, it's the other. I've got so many of them. You know, I think it's like buying things in the moment of passion, you know, where it's just like an impulse buy and you quickly make a decision and you spend a bunch of money on something. And then you realize, you know, when it shows up from Amazon or it shows up and you're like, I don't really need this. You know, why?
OK, give me an example. Was it a drone? Did you get a drone, a $600 drone?
Yeah, that's pretty bang on. I would say drone and technologies for sure, you know, whether it would, you know, certain kind of high-end laptops or gaming machines, those types of things for sure.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I would think for me it would be savings, you know, and ensuring people are not living paycheck to paycheck, that they have a rainy day fund, and if something happens, they can get through it, and that there's a little bit of cash so they're not stressed out as much.
What is the number one lesson you think young people need to learn when it comes to money?
I think it's not about how much you bring in. It's about how much you save. You know, you see so many people that are spending as much as they're making. They're living kind of on the edge. And you really want them to understand that you have to find a way to live within your means and go without and maybe save for a bit of, or a period of time and then make that spend.
Kevin, thank you for your wisdom and perspective. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Kevin Crow, the founder of Give a Mile. He joined us from Calgary, Alberta. That is our program for today. Thank you for joining us. You can always listen to past episodes. To do that, just head on over to iTunes, and you can even subscribe so your next episode of Moolala will magically arrive on your phone, your iPad, or through your drone. I don't know. You can send us questions to ask@moolala.ca, @BruceSelry on Twitter. Facebook is Bruce Selry Moolala. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great day. We'll see you next week.